Okay, so this afternoon I'd like to offer some reflections on the teaching of anatta, or non-self. The Buddha framed part of the teaching very simply, saying that all conditioned phenomena are dukkha, in the sense that they are innately unable to provide a lasting happiness or freedom. He said all conditioned phenomena are anicca, that the ripples of ever-present change and instability run through all events, all lives, all experiences. And he says all phenomena are anatta, or empty of self, that there is no eternal center. Know that all phenomena are empty of independent self-existence. Now the teaching of anatta, non-self, and the teaching of shunyata, or shunya, or emptiness, was probably one of the most radical teachings of the Buddha in his time, where he very much lived in a world where all around him people were engaged in heroically an endless quest to secure a present and a future self. And this was done through rituals, through identity, through role, through accumulating merit, through sacrifice. And the invitation to investigate whether the whole notion of a self, central to all experience and present in all things, was quite radical, in that it very much challenged the worldview of the time, mm-hmm. and of course it very much challenged people's personal views. And in our time, I think there's a certain timelessness to this whole pursuit of preserving and maintaining a present and future self. I think in our times and world, we engage actually in not so dissimilar pursuits. You know, how do we define ourselves? We rely upon what we have, what we possess. We may seek forms of identity through a particular role, a position that we have, or through a relationship. Being a parent, being a partner, being a child. We try to secure a present, fairly unassailable self, and perhaps deep in our hearts, we find ourselves hoping or craving for a continuation of me. You know, I came across someone wearing, a young person wearing a t-shirt last year, and on the front of it was written, "Actually, it really is all about me." I rather admired this. I thought, finally, someone has the courage to put it out there in an unashamed way. And you think about what is our emotional response to the proposal, or the proposition, that the sense of I, a solidified, eternal, ongoing me, may be just a view. It may be just a perception. It may be just something of an illusion, like a mirage in a desert, or like the illusion that because we can see the sun rise in one direction and go down in the other direction, it appears the sun is circling the earth. That is what we see, even though we know it's not so. What is our response to the possibility that it's actually really not all about me? That the body, emotions, perceptions, intentions, mind, all experiences in the moment are not mine. They don't belong to me. They're not who I am. When you think about what is our response to that, do we find ourselves being a bit dismissive? Do we hear a little voice inwardly saying, "Of course I am. I think, therefore I am. Look at my life. my story, my narrative, my history, all of my experiences, do we find ourselves somewhat disturbed by that proposition? Thinking, what would give meaning to my life? Who would live it if I'm not here? You know, what would get me out of bed in the morning? What would give me any sense of direction or aspiration? We might hear the voice inwardly that says, but look at everything I've done. You know, look at everything I've created. Look at everything I wish to do. Is our response perhaps one of a little agitation? You know, what about my future? What about my hopes and my dreams and my longings and my individuality? Or sometimes do we even hear it as kind of good news? We're aware of what hard work it is to be a self. And sometimes we just get a little bit tired of ourselves. At times, you ever have that? So a little bit tired of this narrative, you know. A bit tired of this sense of me to protect and to assert, and it's kind of wearisome sometimes. Now, interesting, you know, the sense of self is a very felt experience, isn't it? We feel like a self. You know, when we look in the mirror in the morning, you know, we say, hi, Joan. We would be surprised to see Jimi Hendrix. You know, we feel like a self. And we recognize ourselves and we know who we are, but we feel like it. And I think this is one of the primary reasons why we find the possibility of non-self in a way kind of unpalatable, but in a way also implausible, because we wonder what would hold it all together. You know, what would hold it all together? My story and my life and my future and my relationships. And we wake up in the morning and we find ourselves waiting, don't we? Kind of like a sort of comfortable old pair of slippers beside the bed. You know, we just slip right into me, you know, and go on about our day. Now, the Buddha did not teach no self, and I really want to stress this. This was not what the Buddha taught. You know, he did not teach no self. In fact, he taught this was a very dangerous concept, to have the concept of no self. That if we held the concept of no self, we would have no moral compass, we would have no ethical guidelines, we have no way of taking responsibility or being accountable for our lives, we would have no sense of aspiration. In fact, he even went on to say, you know, if you were presented with two views of there being an eternal self or there being no self, he says you would be better off taking the view of there being an eternal self, because the other one is simply, you know, so unhelpful and positively even dangerous in our lives. Plus, it would make us dysfunctional, wouldn't it? I mean, it's really good news. We know where we live, and we know what bed to get into, and with who, and we can identify our children, and, you know, we go out of here, and we put on the right pair of shoes most of the time. And it's quite useful to have this kind of self that can make its way through the world. Instead, the Buddha taught non-self, that there is no thing that has an independent self-existence. And he taught a way to bring clinging to a view of self to an end. And the Buddha described clinging to the view of self as an irritation, a vexation, a fabrication, an affliction. And he proposed, actually, that the majority of our struggles and our difficulties, our fears, our conflicts, our confusions, our psychological and emotional suffering stem from the reification of a self. A centralized view of self, both inwardly and outwardly. Because the Buddha didn't just speak about the view of self as me. He spoke about the way that we create a view of self in all people and in all things. How we centralize self. And he taught that the very profound release of the view, the end of the clinging to the view of self, really opens the door to a very profound peace and inner freedom, and actually brings all conflict and struggle and fear to an end, expressed in an unshakable kindness and compassion and equanimity, a life imbued with joy. And the Buddha described this release of this clinging to a view of self as a process of unbinding, a process of untangling. I very much like this verse from one of the texts where the Buddha says, "Through many lives I sought in vain the builder of this house of pain. Now, builder, thee I plainly see. This is the last abode for me. The gables yoke and rafters broke. My heart has peace." My heart has peace. This is a really profound teaching. That I have sought the builder of this house of pain. And now, builder, thee I plainly see. My heart has peace. Now, there is a tendency, I find it somewhat amusing, but there is a tendency I know in retreat teaching to somehow reserve the talk on non-self for the last night of a retreat. You know, as if the whole retreat is building up to this climax, you know, and then you're going to get the really big teaching that's going to make total sense. Almost suggesting that it's such a complex teaching that we have to be sort of deeply prepared and receptive. And, you know, this is not entirely untrue, because I think for us to undertake any meaningful investigation does require some depth of calm and some depth of stillness and mindfulness and curiosity. Now, these words, anatta, non-self, emptiness, voidness, they sound like such big and weighty words, don't they? But it's also important to acknowledge that the Buddha never reserved these teachings for his graduate students. In fact, I think they were very much in the second discourse that the Buddha ever gave. I think there's a real encouragement for us not to be intimidated by the words, because it's very clear in this path, in this teaching, that this is an understanding accessible to us all. And that the freedom and the peace offered by this understanding is also accessible to us all. In fact, I would go so far as to say that in truth, everything that we do in this practice and everything we do in this path is dedicated to the process of emptying all moments of self. Dedicated to emptying all moments of selfing, of reification, of clinging. We're actually engaged in the practice of emptying. That's an interesting framework. How do we approach this practice as one of emptying the moment of selfing? And this could, of course, can only happen, can only be cultivated in the moments we are present in, because this is not a concept, this is not a theory, this is really an applied investigation, it's an applied understanding. Now, personally, I very much like this metaphor of house building. You see on the roads in this country these trucks, you know, and they're carrying aggregates.
Yes.
I think that's just amazing, because, you know, the Buddha described this whole process of body, feeling, perception, consciousness as the aggregates that build a self, you know. And so you see all these construction trucks moving around, you know, they're building houses with all these aggregates. There's some sort of surreptitious Buddhist influence in there, isn't there? But I like the metaphor of house building and the view of self as being the house builder. The way, you know, you can almost see this, can't you? The way that we seek to establish a home, an abode, an identity, a center, moment to moment through our lives. The way that we're seeking to build the house we want to live in or think we want to live in. Now, the primary mechanism we use in this house building is through clinging and identification that creates the abode or the house of I am. And this is me. And this belongs to me. Now, this process of house building is something we can track and trace in our own experience. I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I've had it because I travel quite a bit. And I've had this experience many times of waking up in the morning completely disoriented. And I have absolutely no idea where I am. Not a clue, either. And I remember years and years and years ago, that used to kind of instigate a bit of a sort of, you know, like I have to know where I am. And now I actually really love those moments. I wake up, I have no idea where I am. And then I realize, when I have no idea where I am, I also don't know who I am. And I have no idea what I'm doing there. I'm just in this kind of like, it's almost like pre-perception. You know, it's a kind of pre-perception state. It's before we start to kind of fit everything into its neat little compartments. It's pre-verbal, it's pre-construction experience. And then perception kicks in. I'm very aware of this. Perception kicks in, and I start to recognize something, you know. Oh, yes, those are Holiday Inn cartons, you know, or you know. That's a Crowne Plaza dresser, you know, I know this, you know. And the moment perception begins to kick in and make the world familiar, I arrive, you know. And I arrive at being somebody, and I know what I need to do. And suddenly my world has suddenly all come together in this very familiar shape. Now, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. Now, that emotionally can all be just functional and neutral. Or it can be surrounded by anxiety and clinging and identification and the need to actually build a house. It all depends on whether that seeing is born of confusion or born of understanding. There's a wonderful bit of a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. She says, when I think of the long history of the self on its journey to becoming the whole self, I get tired. It was the kind of trip you keep making over and over again, the bag you pack and repack so often. The shirts start folding themselves the minute you take them off. Isn't that kind of familiar? That sort of that familiarity of that. Now, the Buddha speaks of the idea, the view of self, in three different ways. Now, the first of these is called Sakkaya Ditti. This is personality view. The second of these is called Mana, or the conceit of self, the way that we position ourselves in relationship to the many selves that we encounter in this life. And the third way speaks of understanding self and non-self is in shunya or shunyata or emptiness. That not only is it impossible to find an abiding, independent self within this particular being, but that it's quite impossible to find an abiding, independent self at the center of anything at all. There is a quote from Hui Ning. He says, "You must surely know emptiness is a perfect grass. This emptiness is bound to bloom, like hundreds of grasses blooming. Seeing a dazzling variety of the flowers of emptiness, we surmise an infinity of the fruits of emptiness. We observe the bloom and fall of the flowers of emptiness and learn the spring and the autumn of them. Now, for the purposes of today, I'd like to focus primarily on these first two domains of the view of self, of personality view and conceit of self, primarily. Since the understanding of emptiness is really, I think, the natural, very natural, organic outcome of truly understanding these first two domains. Now, personality view, this is actually not complex. I think this is a really accessible investigation. You know, it's not at all complex. It may be more challenging to truly internalize it and feel the liberation of it, but it's not at all complex to understand Sakkayaditti. Whereas mana, or the conceit of self, I think this is a little bit more elusive. This is a little bit more concealed, a little bit more hidden. By the way, if you want to place these in the grand pathway of awakening, Sakkayaditti, or the freedom from personality view, is said to be very realizable. It's actually often classed as being in the first stage of awakening. Whereas mana, the realization, the deep understanding of mana, is actually one of the very, very last things to disappear, if you want a timetable. So let's start with what's in here. So let's start with what's accessible. Sakkayaditti, or personality view. It's how you view yourself right now. Right now, how you view yourself, how you are right, who you are right now, how you would describe yourself right now. You know, if you were to stand up here and introduce yourself to everybody, you know, what would be the story? What would be the narrative? What would you say? You know, what would you present? You might present your mind state as being the definition of who you are, or an emotion, you know, that I'm sad, or I'm angry, or I'm disappointed, or I'm bored, or I'm uncomfortable. You know, you might present yourself by your gender, or by your body, you know, or by your role, or, you know, by your profession, or by your relationship. You know, it's kind of what you tell the world, you know, it's what you tell the world, because it's what we tell ourselves in that moment, that this is who I am. We might describe ourselves by how I feel. You know, I feel really good right now. I feel really bored right now. Or I'm obsessive right now. Or I'm preoccupied right now. This is Sakkayaditti. It's the I am, fill in the blank, of the moment. Of the moment. This is personality view. This is Sakkayaditti. Sometimes it's really intense, isn't it? It's really turned up a very high volume, you know? Oh, I am, you know? And sometimes it's just this kind of quiet murmur in the background, you know? We're just kind of taking myself for a walk through the day, you know? I'm like this, I'm like that, you know, I feel like this, I like this, you know? It's just that kind of background, little narrative, little song we're hardly aware of until we look more closely. And then, if you were to get up here and introduce yourself, like yourself of this moment, and then if you were to cast your mind back, even just a few hours ago, you know, has your view of self changed? Has your view of self changed? Is your pre-lunch self the same as your post-lunch self? You know, is your breakfast self the same as your supper self? You know, is your get up in the morning self the same as your go to bed at night self? You know, what kind of changes have you seen yourself go through today? And then, of course, you could cast your mind back even further in life and remember all the views of self you've held, all the houses you've inhabited. You know, all the houses you have inhabited and was possibly sure you were going to live there forever. You know, like you'd made your final move. You know, think of the house you inhabited as a child or as a teenager, for heaven's sake. You know, think of the house you inhabited in your first relationship or your first breakup, as a student or as a parent. all the changing faces of identities, all the changing views that we've moved through in our lives. And do you remember sometimes how really substantial some of those houses felt? You know, like I'm going to be forlorn forever. I'm going to be heartbroken forever. I'm always going to be a hippie. You know, I'm always going to be a radical. I'm always going to stay in love. That's a good one. Amen. I'm always going to be an anxious person. This is how I am. You know, this is who I am. Now, the degree of substantiality of the houses we build is directly related to the intensity of the degree of clinging and identification. It's totally related. The substantiality of our houses is directly related to the intensity of the clinging and identification of the moment. And you mean, sometimes you see we're kind of inhabiting some pretty flimsy shacks, aren't we? And sometimes we're inhabiting moated castles. Sometimes we're inhabiting, you know, little huts made of reeds where the wind just blows through. And sometimes they're much, much stronger. We see this view of self, don't we, just arising almost like a pulse. Arising almost like a pulse through our day, through our reactions, through our clinging to the sense of the body, through our clinging to a mood, clinging to a perception, clinging to a feeling. But some of those are very, very changeable, aren't they? It's like the foundations are so weak, and sometimes we just have sufficient mindfulness to know it, you know, and we see it dissolve. You know, we turn the I am into a question of am I. You know, sometimes there's just enough mindfulness to know we're in the process of house building, the possibility to step out of it. And sometimes we inhabit fortresses. You know, views of self that are so historical, so embedded, so familiar. You know, a couple of months ago I was in the post office and I was going up to the cash register to pay. And there was this young woman ahead of me coming from the other direction. And I said to her, you know, please go ahead, you know. And she looked at me in astonishment and she said, that's amazing. And I said, but why is it amazing? And she says, because I'm the kind of person people always push in front of. And I was just so struck by the sadness of that. You know, I'm the kind of person who's so invisible that people always push in front of. And it just struck me about what a kind of fortress, how many life experiences that view of self had been built upon. You know, what a kind of history of pain or invisibility that view of self had been built upon like a fortress. And then to carry that view through life almost as if it was a self-perpetuating kind of experience, you know, self-perpetuating kind of experience. I'm always going to be like this. I'm a shy person. I'm an extroverted person. I'll never be happy. I'll never be successful. I'll never be adequate. It's so observable how much the solidity of our house building really tends to gather most intensely around what we find it really hard to accept in ourselves. What we really find it hard to care for, it's in ourselves. How often the intensity of that house building really, you know, is so, rests so much upon this whole inwardly directed craving or aversion. And it intensifies so that what we actually perceive is the imperfect. What we actually see is the imperfect. It's like the tendency to grab upon, seize upon a fragment of our being and mistake it to be the whole. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. I seize upon a moment of inadequacy or a sadness or a loneliness, and I mistake it to be the whole. This is who I am. And how we which of course it can never be a truth. But with that bias, that selective perception, you know, pushed by craving and aversion, it can never see the whole. It doesn't notice the parts of ourselves that are quite well. It's completely amnesic about those moments of generosity, those moments of kindness, those moments of compassion. Instead, it builds around a fragment and makes it into the whole. And of course, we do this not only to ourselves, do we? We also are very generous with that tendency. And we do it to others. You know, not only I am like this, you are like that. And so we have seized upon the fragment in another person. It might be something they do, it might be something they say, it might just be how they look, it might be what they remind us of. And you are like this. Not perceiving that the fullness of this living, breathing human being with longings and aspirations and deserving of respect and of care. Now, these historical views of self, these personality views, they actually become a pattern, they become a tendency in themselves, almost like a default position. The body is perceived as self, feeling, perception, volition, consciousness, perceived as self. I am the owner of all of this. I am defined by all of these. So what the Buddha quite, I think, intelligently and kindly offered as a proposal is that self is a verb.
Yes.
It's not a noun. Self is not a state. Self is a verb. That there is a process of selfing. A process of selfing. And in Buddhist psychology, that there is this continuum outlined where craving and aversion intensify into clinging. Clinging without mindfulness intensifies into what is called becoming. I start to become the anger. I become, starting to become the anxiety. I'm becoming the sadness. And then I arrive, the house we inhabit. I am. I am. But you see the process that has moved in this. And with mindfulness, we actually do learn to be more aware, more sensitive in this process. We learn that we can, when we can calm the craving and the aversion, we are in doing that calming the inclination to cling, and we're calming the selfing. These very powerful tendencies, but their power relies upon the absence of mindfulness. And their power relies upon the absence of investigation. And as we cultivate that capacity that we all have, for mindfulness and kindness and curiosity, it avails us of the possibility of more and more seeing the transparency of personality view. Mm. That I am, that self is not a noun, not an entity, not an essence, not a state, and it's clearly not independent. But this is a verb and a process. And the introduction of clinging, if you think about this, what the introduction of clinging does, it turns a process into a state. You see that?
Yeah.
You know, something is moving along and you introduce this added ingredient of clinging into it, and process is turned into a state and a self-definition. Mm-hmm. Now, this view of self, of course, is not independent. Our view of self and our personality view is shaped by the interaction with other. The other is the world of events and experiences, what we receive through our sense doors, the body, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, and the sense door of the mind. These are the building blocks, sights, sounds, sensations, thoughts, smells. We not only interact with the other, we react to the other. You know, things I welcome, things I reject, things I like, things I don't like, the sights, the sounds, the thoughts I fear, and those that I want. And then all of this is unseen, That's when it gets magnified into this tighter and tighter world of clinging that shapes our self-view. But it's interesting that the view of self also shapes the world of the other, doesn't it? If the view of self is shaped by this interface with the other and by clinging, then the view of self is actually then shaping that world of experience. And that's where I start to say, that's beautiful, and that's ugly, and that's good, and that's bad, and that's desirable, and that's undesirable, that makes me so happy, that makes me so unhappy. What we have done in that is actually created an independent self-existence in the other. Just as we've created it in ourselves, we create an independent self-existence in the other that then has this implicit power to delight or to sadden me. Language, the English language is very difficult because so many of our sentences begin with the word I. You know, I want or I don't want or I'm doing or I'm not doing, you know, or I like or I dislike or I fear this. You know, it's almost suggestive. The language itself is almost suggestive of this kind of autonomous me doing all of this. And, you know, we're not going to change our language, so we need to change our understanding of our language. In reality, sights, sense, sensations happen. They arise. The world of conditions is one that we have never, ever been able to control, even though we think we should be able to. You know, and it goes back to what I was talking about yesterday when Paul Brocks asked the question, you know, who rains the rain and who thunders the thunder? It's not as if I am doing all of this. It is a way that conditions and process are coming together in a particular matrix and appearance. And all of this can be happening on the ground of confusion or the ground of understanding, but that ground is in our hands. That ground doesn't lie somewhere else. That ground is in our hands. I do not cling. I do not cling to things. I do not grasp hold of things. Clinging and grasping happens when craving and aversion is fed through preferences, through fears, through anxieties, through insufficiency. I also do not let go. We see this in our own experience. Now the Buddha put it that when no view of self is clung to, no view at all is clung to. Because we begin to see that the only thing that keeps anything fixed in place as a reified eternal thing, is our view of it. Have you ever had somebody say to you, and it's usually in an unpleasant moment, I know you? What does that feel like? Does it feel like you've been locked in this box? You know, I know you. As if you're never allowed to be a fluid, dynamic, unfolding, changing being. I know you. And yet this is what our view is doing all the time, isn't it? That's ugly. That's beautiful. That person, you are so annoying, you are so irritating. We go through life saying, I know you. And there's a finiteness created. A finiteness created that doesn't allow for this fluidity, this dynamic unfoldment, which is truly the heart of all things. Truly the heart of all things and all beings. Isn't it something much more wondrous to say, I don't know you? You know? Or I don't know this? Mm-hmm. To be able to learn, to be able to be touched, to be able to be informed by, to allow the moment to tell its story to us, rather than endlessly superimposing our narrative and our story of knowing upon all things. Because that is a sentence of finiteness. You remember those words by William Blake, that if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is infinite. It's taking away that knowing. If the doors of perception were cleansed, we would appear, you would appear as we are, infinite. When no view at all is clung to, there is the end of contractedness, the end of fear, the end of pursuit, the end of avoidance. There is peace and liberation. Now, the second way that the Buddha talks about this notion of self is the way that the view of self is reified through what in Pali is called mana, which really awkwardly translates as the conceit of self. But it's actually quite specific. It's the positional self. That's what I think of it. It's the positional view of self. It's the way that I position myself in relationship to you. When you walk into this room, or when you meet another person, do you see yourself as being somewhat better or superior to that person? Do you see yourself or view yourself or feel yourself to be somewhat inferior or less good? Or do you view us all as being equally confused? I might see myself as being less inferior, less able, less confident, less lovable, less perfect than you. I might see myself as being superior, somehow better, more perfect, more adequate, more loving, more smart, more worthy, more special than you, or see all things, all of us as being kind of foolish beings muddling our way through life, condemned to mediocrity. This is a real thing, by the way. You know, I went home. I went to my hotel last night, and I went into Sainsbury's, and there was this really unpleasant encounter of a customer shouting at the person behind the cash register, pretty abusive. And I thought, well, what makes that happen? What allows that to be? I mean, would I shout at someone that I saw to be somehow more capable, more confident, you know, better than me? Or would I just shout at someone because I actually feel they are shoutable at? Because they are somehow inferior or less able or less deserving than myself. It so struck me at how subtle this mana is. It's hidden, but it has such a very powerful impact in every area of our lives, upon our speech, upon our intentions, upon our actions and our choices. You know, mana might influence whether you sit in the front of the hall or the back of the hall. It might shape whether you feel confident enough to ask a question or whether you always keep silent. It might shape about what you aspire to and what you feel to be impossible for you in your life. It might shape the kind of effort that you bring to this practice, you know, whether you feel, you know, you're zooming in on awakening or whether you feel, you know, lucky if you bump into a breath every now and then, you know. Mana shapes our whole life. Mana shapes our whole life. It is so deeply rooted in a view that feels so intractable. And so it might, sometimes this mana, this view of self, very sadly, doesn't begin with us. It begins with the story that's being told to us by others.
Yeah.
If you're told through your life that you're somehow incompetent or unlovable or imperfect, you know, that gets absorbed. If you're told through your life, you know, that you have this destiny because you're better than everybody else, you're smarter, you know, you come from a better family, it gets absorbed. You know. There's ways that collectively and culturally, through time, we have told the story of mana to groups of people, to, you know, for a whole range of different reasons, until it's become an accepted norm of superiority, inferiority, or sameness, much to the great sorrow of many of our cultures.
Yeah.
Mana and personality view, these are really interactive processes. I think it's really important to see that, you know. And I hope you can kind of naturalize the word mana, because I think the word conceit of self has a particular association of being smug or stuck up. You know, it's not really a very good translation. You know, but this positional selfing or mana, I think you can naturalize this. It's always interacting with personality view. For example, if I hold the particular relational self view, mana, that I believe myself to be inferior, how is that going to shape the personality view of the moment? I'm probably going to be hypervigilant to every mistake I made. You know, I'm probably going to be comparing myself a lot with other people. I'm probably going to be prone to seize upon the imperfect and deem myself a failure. If I, in the moment, you know, I am, oh, you know, I'm no good at this. I'm probably going to be very self-conscious, you know. You know, I might come in late or, you know, drop my lunch in the dining hall, you know, and see a future of being endlessly condemned to being a mindless yogi, you know. But it helps to shape the personality view of the moment. Probably if we inhabit that mana of being less than, we'll be very, very familiar with the voice of the inner critic and the inner judge, you know, evaluating, seizing upon imperfection, always almost anticipating failure. You know, I remember years ago going to the opening of the new hall at Amaravati Monastery. There were hundreds of people there. You know, and they brought in all these big ajahns from Thailand, you know, the big, big ajahns, you know, and they were all lined up on the stage, rows and rows of them, you know. And it was a very important occasion, you know. Parts of the royal family were there, you know, and, you know, there were hundreds of people looking at all these ajahns lined up on the stage. And a good 80% of them were doing this. And you know what? They weren't actually deep in meditation. They were actually nodding off. You know? And they were totally, completely fine about it. They were totally, completely fine about it. Like this was completely a non-event. They were just tired, you know. But you could imagine if you were in that position up on the stage with hundreds of people looking at you and expecting grand things of you. And you just... If you were in the mana, the inferiority conceit, that would be a difficult moment, wouldn't it? It would be a difficult moment. But it didn't shape a sense of shame or personality view or what a failed meditator they were. If I believe myself to be superior than you or somehow better than you, I'm probably going to reverse this tendency. I'm going to be highlighting your faults. I'm going to be on the lookout for your imperfections because my superiority relies upon you being worse than me, you being somehow lesser than me. So I'm going to have to bolster my superiority by constantly finding that which is imperfect in you so I can feel better about myself, more able. I'm going to strive a lot, and I'm probably going to be quite defensive and fearing that the loss of that position, that stature. So we see that everything in a mana is constantly shaping personality view, but personality view, the shaping of personality view goes back to deepen and reinforce that positional selfing. It's a closed feedback loop. It's a closed feedback loop. But there is a way out. You know, and the way out, I think, begins exactly where we can begin. With actually really beginning to be so sensitized inwardly to the whole sense of personality view appearing, the I am. And to turn that into a question, am I? Or to know, this is the I am of the moment. You know, to be able to hold that with some humor, you know. The I am of this moment is like this. You know, it's like this. It's like this. It's like this. Or now it's like this. Isn't that curious? This changing process. But notice, it's so important to notice that the tendency to cling or to grasp, to identify, has a certain amnesic quality to it. Because, you know, the moment when we're caught in that, really in that, firmly in that position of, I am so angry, we've completely forgotten the 5 million moments in our life where we are not angry.
That's
true. I would also encourage you, I would also encourage you to really, really notice the many, many moments in your day where there's no I am-ing, where there's no personality view being shaped at all. There are so many of those moments. We just assume that this is a continuum and an ever-present process. But of course it's not. I mean, did anyone brush their teeth this morning? This is not a hygiene check, by the way. But did anyone brush their teeth in the morning and just brush the teeth?
Yeah.
Like, no selfing present, just brushing teeth. You know? I mean, how many moments have there been like that in your day-to-day when you're just doing something without this kind of super consciousness of I am, without there being any clinging or grasping present at all? Do you notice those moments? Do you notice the texture of those moments? Can you, becoming more familiar with those many, many moments of non-clinging, I think we become highly more sensitized to those moments of moving into a process of clinging and identifying. Because it's like moving from a place of opening to a place of contracting. From a place of kind of holding the whole of the moment to a place of seizing upon a particular of the moment and mistaking it to be the whole. And I think sometimes we can get so sort of mission-centered about only being conscious of moments of clinging that we actually hardly even, it's almost like we're feeding it in a way, we're hardly even sensitized to the many, many moments of day when this is simply not taking place. Simply not taking place. Now, the bit about seeing myself as being, us all being the same, that positioning of mana, you know, the equality conceit. You know, which actually usually manifests as a kind of cynicism. You know, no one can do this. You know, we're all failures at this. You know, no one is really a good person. You know, no one's really a compassionate person. We're all like this. You know, we're all swimming in the same soup of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's pretty much a saboteur of aspiration. The one thing that I feel so clearly to notice in all of this is that both personality view and mana, I think, are the greatest saboteurs of the Brahma-Viharas. I think they're the greatest saboteurs of kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, which really rest upon the softening and the dissolving of both the sense of I and the sense of other. And we can see, you know, like when the conceit of self is present, you know, inferiority conceit, you know, how possible is it really to celebrate the well-being of another? You know, how difficult it is to find compassion, you know, how difficult it is to befriend when we're in this almost constant evaluating and comparing and competing positions with all things. So what is the task, what is the invitation, I would say, of this path? It's certainly not to annihilate the self. It's not to shout at ourselves to let go. But I think really the invitation is to cultivate that moment-to-moment spacious awareness and kindness that allows, and stillness that allows the transparency of this self in process to be seen, that allows clinging to fade, that allows craving and aversion to fall away. You know, the Buddha, if you read the early texts, you really see how much the Buddha extols the virtues of homelessness. But it wasn't an encouragement for everybody to abandon their lives and to become a monk or a nun. You know, it wasn't about a geographical homelessness alone or a lifestyle. But I think it was really about a way of inhabiting this life, of yielding the tendency to be a house builder, to yield the tendency to understand, the tendency to build houses based on clinging. And when the Buddha says, when he sees, you know, this is the last, when he says, you know, there were many lives I sought in vain, the builder of this house of pain. Now, builder, thee I plainly see. This is the last abode for me. The gables, yokes, and rafters broke. My heart has peace. The gables, yokes, and rafters, these all refer to the mechanisms of clinging and selfing and identification. When these are broke, my heart has peace. And in this verse, the Buddha very much equates peace with liberation. I want to end with just a small piece from the Udana Sutta in praise of equanimity. For one who clings, motion exists. But for one who does not cling, there is no motion. Where no motion is, there is stillness. Where stillness is, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming or going. Where no coming or going is, there is no arising or passing away. There is neither this world, nor a world beyond, nor a state between. And this verily is the end of suffering. Thank you.